"Not funny," Etta said sharply, stalking down the hall. "Lighten up, Lyndon Hemlock Spencer," he whispered back, jogging to catch up to her. The inner hall muffled the chaos outside of it, but only just. The gunfire was endless, blurring into thunder.
"Maybe we should just hide. Stay here until the trouble passes."
"Until someone finds us and finishes us off," Etta said, catching the first hint of the open window's freezing draft curling toward them. "The way they probably grabbed Henry." Every time she blinked, the explosion seemed to set off again behind her eyes, blinding, disorienting, incinerating her from the inside out. "Did I really leave him?" With a start, she realized she was crying. "Did I leave him there to die?"
"Come now, old girl. It's not as bad as all that," Julian said. "We'll be fine. I can get us out of here in a jiff. There's a passage at the Imperial Academy of Arts, just across the Neva River. How do you feel about sunlight and warmth, and a charming lack of Gatling guns?"
19. Frost covered the window. At some point, the dark sky had begun spitting down snow. Some of it had blown inside through a small crack, leaving a mess on the floor. A few different sets of footprints were already pressed into the slush, leading away from the window. Clearly, others had taken the chance to leave. Outside, she heard the same phrase being chanted in the distance.
"Ochistit dvorets!"
Etta got her hands under the window and tugged up high enough to slip through. The chill cut straight through her flimsy dress and the silk slip beneath. But it was a good sort of cold. It lifted the mental fog, sharpening her thoughts.
"Up you go," Julian said, offering his hands to hoist her up.
Etta ignored him and pulled herself through, despite the pain that lanced through her shoulder and bare feet at the impact on the hard stone path below. Julian landed just as roughly behind her. The palace sat close to the river, separated only by a small street and embankment. There was no one around them that she could see, but Julian heard something. He reached over, switching off her flashlight, and held out an arm to keep her in place as a car raced down the road, slinging mud and slush up into the air. Julian let out a noise of protest as it splattered onto the front of his otherwise pristine trousers. Etta scanned the street and river for any way across both. There seemed to be a bridge in the distance, but between it and them was a mass of humanity making its way down the street. She wasn't about to stick around and see if the marchers were soldiers, or more of St. Petersburg's Petrograd's unhappy population. Julian darted across the street to the embankment, leaning over the wall. He shouted something down. Etta saw his mouth moving, even if she couldn't make out his words. The fact that her hearing hadn't fully come back, that she was still drowning beneath that same piercing whine, threatened to sink her with fear. Etta limped over to him, peering through the darkness to see what was below. A boatman, as it turned out, in one of three rowboats tied up to the small dock, smoking as if he didn't have a care in the world. The trail of smoke curled up toward them, a wriggling wisp of white. Julian's face was outraged when he looked at her.
"He wants over 7,000 rubles to use one of his damned boats. Said the other servants were willing to pay him to ferry them. I don't have that kind of money, do you?"
After everything that had happened over the course of the last hour, Etta felt a strange, unnatural calm settle over her. Improvised explosives were a problem. Fleeing a furious mob was a problem. Greedy boatmen were not. "May I have the flashlight?" she asked, holding out her hand. He passed it to her, but tried to tuck it back at the last second.
"What are you planning? You've got that deranged look in your eye."
Etta yanked it out of his hand and sidled up over the wall, then down the short hill that brought her to the wooden dock.
"English?"
she called out. The boatman stood up, stepping out of the boat, a leering smile on his face. His eyes skimmed over the place where the strap of her dress had ripped, exposing one shoulder.
"Little English for little lady."
Etta mentally gagged as she returned his smile with one of her own, and said in what she hoped was a sweet tone, "Yes, a little lady in desperate need of help. Will you be a hero and help a girl out?"
"You're flirting with him," Julian called down in disbelief.
"Where?"
the man asked, smirking. Etta glanced across the wide stretch of the river, to where another imperial-looking building loomed. She pointed, and the man turned his head to follow the line of her arm, her finger. Etta slammed the flashlight into his skull, blowing him back into the boat, where he collapsed, unmoving, stunned but still breathing.
"Good God, Lyndon Hemlock, whoever you are!" Julian cried, stumbling down the hill.
Etta threw the broken remains of the flashlight into the nearest boat, and reached down to untie the boat the man had fallen into, letting it drift into the patches of ice on the Neva. She thought about apologizing, but then decided that moment that she just didn't care. A pirate wouldn't apologize or thank him. A pirate would just take. And if she had to shut off some crucial, feeling part of herself to survive this and find her way back to the real pirate in her life, she would. She heard Nicholas's voice whisper in her ear, a protesting, "Legal pirate, thank you." And for an instant allowed the small, sad laugh to bubble up in her chest. Julian gave her a look that told her exactly what he thought about that laugh. "Spencer," she told him. "My last name is Spencer." Etta quickly stepped down into the boat, feeling it wobble beneath her feet. It steadied with the added weight of Julian, allowing her to easily reach up and unknot the line anchoring it to the dock. They drifted out toward the clumps of ice forming in the river's slow waters, and for a moment they both looked at each other expectantly. "I would row," Etta told him, "except my shoulder is killing me, and I can barely move my arm. So maybe you could try contributing to this escape?"
"Of course," he said quickly, not meeting her gaze. "I was just waiting to see if you'd be stubborn enough to attempt it yourself."
Julian picked up the oars, got them on either side of the boat, and then lifted them up and down in the water, doing little more than splashing. Etta stared at him. She was freezing, tired, shaken, and on the verge of reaching over to strangle him for even trying to make a joke at a time like this. But he kept doing it, his brow wrinkled as if confounded about why the boat was slowly turning in a circle and not moving across the water as expected.
"Are you serious?"
she asked him in disbelief.
"You don't know how to row a boat?"
His shoulders set against her words.
"I'll have you know, Nick was always there to do it when the situation called for it."
Etta felt her jaw tighten to the point of pain as she held out her hands. He hesitated a moment before passing the heavy oars over. With a movement that made her shoulder protest pitifully, she got the boat turned around, her back to the other bank, and made the first long stroke. Those days with Alice rowing by the low boathouse in Central Park had been for something more than enjoyment after all. Julian released a relieved sigh, leaning back to look up at the snow falling on them. No matter what he did, he always seemed to be posing and waiting for someone to compliment him on it.
"You're rather handy, Lyndon Hemlock Spencer," he said. "That was some brilliant teamwork, if I do say so myself."
"I'm not sure you know what that word means," Etta managed, her teeth clenched. She tried to mine the small bit of gold out of this situation. She was alive, and the rowing was at least warming her stiff muscles. But she could already feel the rising urge to take one of the oars and whack Julian into the freezing water.
"You're the brawn and I'm the brains, kiddo," he told her. "You don't need my help with this."
Etta was beginning to think that the real reason he'd gone to the Thorns was that he was at least self-aware enough to know he wouldn't be able to survive on his own.
"Call me kiddo again."
She felt the words growl out of her throat, too low for her to even hear over the splash of water and the painful ringing.
"Your ear's still giving you a spot of trouble," he asked. "It's a good sign you can hear it all. It means you might heal completely. Lesser explosions have destroyed people's eardrums, from what I understand."
Etta grunted, pulling the full force of her anxiety into the next pull of the oars. Beethoven could compose and play instruments when he was mostly deaf. But she wasn't Beethoven, and the thought of never hearing music again left her feeling as if her chest had been hollowed out. Stop thinking. Just row.
What happened at dinner, exactly? Julian asked. 1 minute I was being berated by the Thorn Guard for innocently inquiring about his mother's species, and the next the whole place started rocking on its bones.
Atta looked down at her lap, avoiding his gaze. She might as well tell him. Though it seemed unlikely, Julian might have the answer to the question that had been nagging at her since she'd been jolted back into consciousness. We had just started the last course, when one of the waiters brought out a wine bottle to serve the Tsar. He shouted something and slammed it down onto the table. The next thing I knew, I was on the ground, and half the floor was gone. Henry was hurt badly, and the others... Julian's brow shot up.
Was there liquid in the bottle?
She nodded, pulling the next stroke.
Based on the year, it was probably nitroglycerin. It explodes on impact, very volatile. Even Grandfather didn't like using the stuff.
His expression turned thoughtful.
How on God's green earth did you manage to survive that?
A good question.
Jenkins, the other guard, I mean.
He jumped on it, I think, just before it hit the table. And Henry, he...
I left him there to die. I left him.
Etta wiped the sweat from her forehead with her tattered sleeve.
It was an ironwood.
Both Jenkins and Henry recognized him. But he shouted something before he threw down the explosive. She tried to repeat it the best she could.
Revolutia, maybe. That's revolution, Julian said, his voice oddly quiet. Pretending to play the part of a revolutionary for the assassination. Evil, Grandpops, but rather elegant. There is a rather unfortunate tradition of Tsars being assassinated, so no one would question it.
Etta took a breath, trying to wipe the blood from her face against her shoulder. Her stiff knees ached as she tried to stretch them out in the cramped boat.
So we're back to your grandfather's timeline. Hell if I know, kid, Julian said,
briskly rubbing his arms to try to bring some warmth back into them.
I don't intend to find out, and neither should you. Your opportunity to escape has presented itself, and you are hereby invited to join me in Bora Bora for as long as it takes them to sort this out.
Atta dragged the oars through the dark water again.
I'm not going to Bora Bora. Oh, I wasn't aware that this escape evolved a real plan, but do share.
If the Thorn, Kadir, was found dead, it means your grandfather got to the astrolabe, which means I need to find him, Etta said, explaining it to him slowly, as if he were a small child. His mouth twitched, trying to hide a smile. As far as I know, he's still in 1776 in New York. How do I get back there from this point?
No, Julian said, throwing his hands up in the air. No, because this is absurd. You should just come with me. This doesn't have to be on your shoulders. You don't need the weight of it. It'll just smother you. Come with me to Bora Bora and let the devils have their hell.
It's always that easy for you, isn't it? Etta said, shaking her head. Let everyone else risk their lives to try to fix what your grandfather has done. Don't take any responsibility for your family. He gave her a pitying look that set her teeth on edge.
Christ, you sound like Nick, with all of this talk of responsibility. Morality is a bore, kiddo. And if you think any one person can stop Grandfather, you're mistaken. He was born out of a cloud of sulfur, and his bones are brimstone. Imagine what you could accomplish with your life, she said, if you weren't so damn afraid all the time.
The gentle thud of the broken ice against their boat, and the splash of the oars in the water, was the only conversation for several moments. Julian let out a dramatic sigh and dipped a hand into his jacket, pulling out a small leather notebook.
I suppose I'm going to have to be the lesser person in this situation, and allow you to take the title of bigger.
he said, thumbing through the pages. It must have been his traveler's journal, with notations of where and when he'd been, so he didn't cross paths with an older or younger version of himself.
"Here we are," he said. "There are three passages in this year and city. The one we're headed to will take us to Alexandria, 203 A.D. From there, there's a passage through the Vatican, and from there you can connect to New York in 1939. Little Italy, on Mulberry and Grand."
Etta's grip on the oars tightened.
"How does that help me?"
"You'll just need to get to where Whitehall Dock used to be. There's a passage to 1776, in Boston," he said. "That's the most direct route to that year."
She could find a way from Boston to Manhattan. If nothing else, she could turn herself over to the Ironwood Guardian, who would inevitably be watching the passage, and let him or her bring her to Ironwood for her punishment.
"Why is everyone still banging on about the damn astrolabe?" Julian complained. "It's always been more trouble than it's worth. No one is ever satisfied with life, are they? What more does he have to sacrifice at this point? He's gone and killed his entire family over it."
"I had it." She could hear the pain in her voice. "But it was taken by the Thorns, the ones who went missing. It's my responsibility to find it and finish what I started."
"Why? The timeline's already changed again, and it'll only get worse from here."
Etta leaned forward. "You're sure it changed?"
"You didn't feel it?"
Julian shook his head.
"I suppose not. It's not that different from the pressure of an explosion. The whole world blurs for a moment, and the sound is deafening. It's unmistakable. Whatever this new timeline is, it's bound to be bad."
"More reason to find the astrolabe," Etta said through gritted teeth, "and destroy it in order to reset it back to its original state." Julian wore a strange expression.
"Is Grandpop's timeline really that bad? I wasn't around to see the original one, and neither were you. Who's to say he didn't improve on a few things?"
Etta shook her head. This was the trouble with meddling at all. Who decided what was considered more peaceful or improved? A benefit to one part of the world might be a detriment to the other. You could stop a war, and it might inadvertently cause another. You could change the outcome of a battle, and it would just be the other side who experienced the losses.
"It doesn't matter. No one should have tampered with it in the first place, least of all Cyrus Ironwood."
And even though she already knew what his answer would be, she tried anyway. "You could help me. Find Nicholas and Sophia and the rest of your family. Apologize for tricking them into grieving for you."
"Appealing to a sense of honor only works if a person has one," Julian informed her. "I'll go with you as far as the Vatican, but..."
She heard the crack of the gunshot and its echo as the bullet slammed into the water, sending up a spray of freezing water at them and rocking the boat. Both Etta and Julian ducked instinctively. The next bullet splashed down on the other side of the boat.
"Can't you row any faster?" Julian complained. "Can you try helping?" she fired back.
But Julian had already turned around to shout something at them in Russian. The next shot from the embankment hit the rim of the boat, splintering so close to his hand that Julian yelped in alarm and made as if to dive into the freezing water. Through the curtain of snow, Etta could barely make out the men gathered there, one of whom was climbing down toward the other boat.
"Why are they chasing us?" he complained.
"Thorn!"
one of them bellowed in an American accent. "An Ironwood."
"Come back at once and you will be shown a measure of mercy."
Julian groaned, sinking back against the boat in dismay. Etta's arms worked faster, the oars beating at the water as the other embankment finally came within a few dozen yards.
"It's just not fair. How did you get us into this mess? What kind of bad luck charm are you? Can you please shut up?" she snapped. "Reach for the embankment when you can and pull us in."
The next two gunshots splintered the floating ice, spraying water across her face. Etta's heart felt like it was about to unhook from her chest and pass up her throat. Rather than wait for Julian, she used one of the oars to catch the lip of the embankment and pull them over to it. She felt the slice of a bullet across the back of her exposed neck before she heard it explode through the air. Etta gasped in shock more than pain. "Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Don't think." Hard to ignore a literal brush with death. But Etta slithered up onto the snow-dusted embankment, trying to get her bearings. She clung to her last shreds of focus, swinging her gaze around. Most of the embankment's walls were high, too high to climb up from the water. But just in front of the building, which she hoped was the Imperial Academy of Arts that Julian had mentioned, were steps that led down to the water's edge, guarded by two enormous stone sphinxes facing inward, as if squaring off against each other.
"Don't leave me!"
Julian called out after her, still crouched in the boat. A shot zinged off the stone embankment, forcing Etta's attention up toward the group of rowboats moving toward them, shining flashlights across the dark ice and water.
"They'll kill me,"
he told her in a rush, struggling to reach the embankment again.
"That's why I never came back. Grandfather didn't want me for his heir, and he would have killed me."
She wasn't surprised by Julian's admission, but she also didn't have time for it.
"Come on," she said, stretching a hand out toward him.
Her shoulder was on fire, her ears felt like fireworks had been set off inside them, and her whole body was trembling from the cold. But, digging deeper, she found the last burst of strength she needed to grip his hand and draw the boat forward again. Julian scrambled up onto the embankment, lying as flat as he could across from her, so close that Etta could smell the alcohol on his breath.
"What do we do?"
he asked.
"You said you were the brains," she snapped. "Where's the passage?" "The statues. Do you see them? The right sphinx, just at the base."
The air around its enormous stand did seem to be shimmering, but Etta had chalked that up to shock and exhaustion, and had chalked up the faint drumming buzz in the air, as if it were electrified, to her ears coming back around.
"Then we run," she told him.
It was a short distance, maybe 5 feet. Granted, that would be 5 feet of opportunity to be shot dead, but she liked those odds. Before Julian could launch his newest protest, and before she could give herself time to think about where in the world the passage might open up, Etta pushed onto her feet and ran as hard as she could. She brought her hands up just in case he was wrong, and she was about to slam headfirst into immovable stone.
"Stop! This is your last warning!"
Etta didn't hear the rest. She dove into the wild heartbeat of the passage and felt the pressure of its touch tear at her skin and tattered dress. The dark chaos made her feel like she was spinning head over feet, until it shoved her out with a final, shuddering gasp. Inertia carried her forward into a skidding stop. Her feet slid against rough stone, and she swung her gaze back over her shoulder. A small sphinx, identical to the one that had brought her here, gazed out over a glistening white city and an enormous bay that had turned pink with the sunset. Julian shot out through the passage behind her, snatching her arm and forcing them both back into a run. They dashed around the statue and made their way down a broad avenue. The moon-bright limestone columns and steps led up to buildings that looked more like temples than homes or places of business. Etta dragged in air that was completely void of gasoline, but brimmed with hints of life. Just animal sweat, human waste, and a touch of brine that could only come from being close to the sea. As they kept the darkness, she caught sight of a distant lighthouse between the next two buildings she passed, its bright, watchful eyes sweeping over the harbor below it.
"How much farther?" Etta gasped out.
"We're following this big avenue down until we find a rather handsome temple called the Caesarium. We're looking for two enormous red marble obelisks."
They found them. Her heart felt like it was about to tear out of her chest by the time they reached the passage, and they sped through it into further darkness. Julian slid to a stop on the stone floor, nearly crashing into a row of prayer candles that had carelessly been left to illuminate what appeared to be a church nave. Etta turned, her eyes sweeping over the altar's shadowed cross, then back out at the rows of pews that spread like ribs between the confines of the walls. They were alone, finally.
"Come on," he said. "I'll get you to your passage."
She nodded, rubbing her hands over her face. The Vatican. This wasn't the Vatican she remembered visiting with Alice. It lacked the heartrending works of art and the sweeping grandeur that conspired to make the visitor feel as insignificant in the face of God as the dust on their shoes. It was almost humble.
What year?
1490-something, he said with a vague gesture as they reached the doors. Pressing an ear against them, he was satisfied by what he did or didn't hear, and dragged the heavy doors open just enough for them to slip into the hall. The torchlights blazed on the walls alongside them. Etta tried, failed, to calculate the hour. She reached back to rub her neck, but only felt what wasn't there.
Where?
The chain she'd used to carry her mother's earring had slipped down the front of her dress and caught on the beadwork. But the earring itself was gone. Etta couldn't stop the panic that writhed in her as she looked around the floor for it. Why do I care? She'd used the earrings as proof of her mom's belief in her, to study her when she was afraid. The mere thought of what it represented should have sickened her. And yet, it didn't. Not entirely. Alice, she reminded herself. She killed Alice.
What's the matter? Julian whispered, doubling back when he realized she wasn't behind him.
She looked up.
Nothing. Where to now?
He opened his mouth, eyes narrowing, but thought better of it. They walked in silence, Etta trailing a step behind him as she tried to pull the pieces of herself back together, to forge them into new armor. Julian stopped, backing up a few steps.
Wait.
He looked at his journal, checking something.
This is my stop. Yours is three doors down, just at the entrance to the apartments.
He pushed the door to the small chapel open.
Are you not coming with me? Etta asked. You could do real good.
He threw her one last smirk over his shoulder.
Where's the fun in that, when I could go to Florence instead?
She blew out a harsh breath from her nose, and let her expression tell him what she thought of that. The idea of him slipping away from facing the consequences of his actions sparked that same helpless anger she'd felt while listening to Nicholas confess his pain and shame and doubt over what had happened on the mountain.
"Godspeed, Lyndon Hemlock Spencer," he said,
stepping into the small chapel.
"Here is my final benediction. Wherever your road takes you, may it never cross with grandfather's."
She heard the passage's tempestuous language bang on through the wall.
"A-hole," Etta muttered,
blowing her hair out of her eyes. She had turned to continue down the hall when a sound like a gunshot bit the silence. Something heavy smacked into the door with a grunt of pain. She fumbled with the latch and opened it. Julian spilled out at her feet, blinking up at her. After a moment he pressed his hands against his face and let out a frustrated holler.
"What just happened?"
Etta asked, alarmed. He pushed himself upright and began the impossible work of patting down his unruly hair.
"I got bounced out of the passage. I crossed paths with myself. Some version of me is already there."
"Whoa. Didn't you check your notebook?"
"I did," Julian said, smacking a hand against the stone. "Which means it's the future me, and I haven't gone yet. Damn."
Etta stared.
"Does this happen a lot?"
"To me more than others, apparently. Once or twice it's kept me out of a bad scrape, but I cannot even begin to explain how obnoxious it is to be babysat and scolded by your future conscience. I can't believe future me is such a werp, a chuffing blue nose."
What he was saying seemed possible and impossible all at once, but it was time travel, and the usual rules never did apply.
"You're sure you didn't just get completely drunk and forget to note your visit?" Etta asked, leaning over him.
"I love that you know me so well, Lyndon Hemlock Spencer. But I assure you, no. Say what you will about changing the timeline, but my whole life has been a lesson in self-fulfillment. I can't know what's ahead, but future me knows what's behind. And he's a humorless fool about letting me have my fun."
To her, it sounded like Julian's future self was pretty skilled in keeping himself alive. But Etta kept her mouth shut and moved away,
so he could stand up and brush himself off. "Maybe future Julian wants you to be a better person," she suggested. He pulled a horrified face.
"All right, kid. Let's go to the Big Apple, then. We'll split up in Little Italy. I have a hankering for a good pasta, anyway," he whispered as he stood. "Oh, boy, 1939 means that my old nanny will be there. She retired to her natural time when she was finished with me and Soph. I like to think we were the ultimate cosmic test, and she didn't dare risk getting worse little demons."
"Shh," Etta begged, her head pounding as they walked.
"Shh. I wonder what the old bird is up to. I could give her the fright of her life and drop in," Julian said, his voice low. "You know, I think I'll do just that. And she can keep a secret, especially now that Grandfather no longer controls her purse strings. Or I'll just play it off as past Julian, rather than present Julian.
Etta gave up and let him talk, let him fill her head with his memories, until they pushed away her own painful ones for a time. She tried to bring up Nicholas's face, to imagine finding him after she saw this mess through to its end. But seeing its bold lines, the curve of his contemplative smile, brought no relief. It only made her feel desperately alone. The passage shoved them out together, sending Julian to his knees and throwing Etta on top of him. Black ringed her vision at the jarring impact, and it took her longer than she would have liked to recover enough to stand.
"That was a definite ouch," Julian said, staggering up.
"You sure your head isn't made out of marble?"
Etta held her throbbing arm close to her chest, waiting until the pain passed before saying,
"Sorry."
They'd landed in the middle of a rocky, fog-smothered path. Etta could hardly see a few inches in front of her, let alone take in what was supposed to have been the city's skyline.
"Manhattan, huh?" she said,
turning to Julian with an arched brow.
"What was that about having excellent records?"
But Julian was rooted to the spot, one hand twisting the front of his shirt.
"No, Etta," he said. "This is New York City.
In prehistoric times?"
The terrain was wild, craggy hills shadowed by thick, silky fog. Etta could just make out the shape of other mounds in the distance. Someone nearby had lit a fire. The smell of charred wood bloomed in the air. The silence breathed thickly around them, as if trying to get her attention, to tell her something.
"Listen. Maybe we took the wrong passage out of the Vatican," she suggested.
"No,"
Julian said, the word harsher now. He still hadn't moved.
"This is New York."
Etta was about to shake him when a breeze stirred the fog, swirled it. The muddied shapes, which had clearly been hills and rough terrain, were now sloping piles of brick and stone, the warped frames of buildings and burned-out bodies of cars. The frost near her feet wasn't frost at all, but shattered glass. Flecks of white flurried around her, and for one stupid, insane second, Etta thought, "Snow. It's snowing." But the only thing falling around them was ash. Vatican City, 1499. 20. The darkness never lifted. For a single terrifying moment, Nicholas was certain he, too, had somehow lost vision in one or both of his eyes. The blackness was absolute. The air breathed around him, thick enough to slice into ribbons. Already unsteady from exhaustion and, Christ, blood loss, he landed hard enough on his knees to nearly bite off his own tongue. Sophia almost slipped out of his arms. He gripped the back of her tunic for purchase, avoiding her cold, slick skin.
"Sophia,"
he said, his voice echoing back to him threefold.
"Sophia, can you hear me?"
Silence. Stillness. The touch of death, he thought. The hairs on his body prickled to attention as panic surged through him, and he shook her gently, trying to provoke any sort of cutting word.
"Sophia!"
"Give her to me,"
Lehman said, forcing the matter. He should have fought her. He should have argued with her for propriety's sake. But there wasn't the time, and he hadn't the strength. Sophia was inches taller than her, but the other young woman easily arranged her on her back and carried her forward quickly, her steps light. Nicholas was horrified that, even with the additional weight gone, his limbs dragged as if he were deep in his cups. Pounding steps, or perhaps his own heart. No, there was another sound underscoring it, one that pierced his awareness. Someone was dragging a blade against stone, and he felt it. He felt it as if the sword or knife were scraping at his own bones.
"There's nowhere you can hide that we won't find you,"
Miles Ironwood.
"Come out now, Carter, and I'll let you choose how you'd like to die."
The other men laughed in response to Miles's threat. Nicholas barely managed to catch his tongue before he shouted something back.
"Blade or barrel, blade or barrel," Miles sang out. "I don't think you want the old man to choose for you. Blade or barrel, what'll it be, Carter? My knife or gun at your throat?"
Lee Min muttered something he was sure was an oath.
"This way."
Her voice floated to him through the darkness, bounced between whatever walls were around them, cutting through even the passage's groaning.
"Where?"
He coughed, trying to clear the tightness in his throat.
"Where are you?"
It was so dark, so very, very dark and still. There wasn't a hint of starlight or moonlight to warm the air with their glow, and there was no wind stirring against his skin. The utter stillness of this place was devastating, terrifying. There did not seem to be a beginning or end to it.
"Get up!"
Lee Min sounded nearly breathless. "Where are we? A cellar of some sort?" Holy Christ, why hadn't he even thought to ask before he'd gone charging through the passage?
"Get a hold of yourself."
Nicholas was nearly frenzied with the need to seize some sort of control, some understanding over what was happening. Over the scraping and footfalls there was a snick of sound, and a small spark of light floated like a firefly a few yards in front of him. His mind reached through its tangled mess of chaos for the word. Match. Lee Min had lit a match. She drew it close to her face, illuminating the stark lines of concern etched there.
"She's not," he tried to tell her. "I can't."
"We haven't much time. Stand up, Nicholas Carter. If you cannot, then I will carry you both."
His legs bobbed like a newborn calf's, but Nicholas, seemingly by the grace of God alone, got his feet under him. His eyes had adjusted to the darkness well enough to see the stark lines of the narrow walkway, the walls that opened here and there and doorless entryways. In this state, he couldn't think and walk at the same time, so he shut off the valve to his thoughts and followed each prick of light that the girl lit, until finally they veered off the main walkway, and into what looked like a mausoleum. It was one in a string of three that shared walls. Lee Min had stepped through the nearest, her hand brushing a small engraving of a leaf, nearly hidden by the fading fresco of men. Nicholas stepped down into the structure, carefully balancing as loose stones bit into the thin soles of his sandals.
"Is she alive?"
he whispered, but Lee Min ignored the question. Sophia hadn't said a word since they'd made their way through the passage, and he could no longer feel to ensure her chest was rising and falling. He could barely see her in this impenetrable darkness. "You cannot die," he thought, the words searing and unyielding. "You owe me a debt." At his terrified face, the moment before she disappeared, cut through his mind. What would happen if Sophia died? The passage they'd come through would likely collapse, but would she disappear, the way Etta and Julian had when they'd been caught in a wrinkle and tossed through time? "I need your help." Desperation turned his stomach hollow.
"I cannot do this without your assistance. Do not die. Do not die. Do not die."
Lee Min blew out her match just as the passage began to make itself known again, beating out a warning against the stale air. Reinforcements. Nicholas clenched his jaw, struggling with the pain in his shoulder, the way it leached at his strength. Lee Min grunted in the darkness, adjusting Sophia's weight.
This way.
From what he'd seen before the light went out, there was nowhere else to go. Nothing to do but hide and hope and pray.
Must be up in the basilica by now. Split up. See if we can find a light.
The voices were thrown between the walls, allowed to volley back and forth, to meet the passage's calls blow for blow.
This way!
Lehman's voice became more urgent. She struck one last match. Nicholas felt himself balk, first at the sight of the open sarcophagus at the center of the mausoleum, and again as Lehman all but shouldered him towards the stairs that had been hidden beneath its lid, and silently urged him down into a darkness deeper than sleep. The quick steps of the ironwoods were pounding down like rain, growing in speed and strength. Nicholas couldn't question it. He had to move. The sensation of descending into a tomb, into a maze of graves and stones, made him feel as if death himself had one hand around his throat, his bony fingers bruising. Nicholas stopped, poised at the edge of the steps. What small sliver of light Lehman's match had provided disappeared as the girl set Sophia down and pulled the lid shut over them. For the first time in a long, long while, since he'd been a child, since his mother had told him to climb into that cupboard and stay hidden until it was safe to come out, Nicholas felt his throat tighten to the point of choking. His mouth had gone so dry it felt as if he were breathing ash in and out of his lungs. Every sense was dampened. What innate sense of direction he possessed was stripped away, leaving him with only touch to feel his way down the last of the steps.
"Through me you enter into a city of woes," he muttered, half delirious. "Through me you enter into eternal pain. Through me you enter the population of loss."
"Abandon all hope, you who enter here,"
Lehman whispered, just above his ear.
"Dante, how original."
Nicholas grunted back, his feet finding flat ground, and his forehead the disastrously low ceiling. His forehead cracked against some sort of stone support, igniting the aches and agony he'd managed to push aside. That was it for him. His body simply ran out of whatever means it had of continuing on. He dropped like a slack sail. Distantly he heard Lehman set Sophia down and race back up the steps to pull the cover back over them. Nicholas fell onto his knees, his strength draining as quickly as the blood from the arrow wound. His limbs shook from the strain of their run, from carrying Sophia's slight weight for as long as he had. And he fought to stay conscious. Inching forward even just a foot felt like a Herculean task, a beast that would not be slaughtered. And then, there was light. It spilled out from a gas lantern in Lehman's hands, illuminating the mosaics on the floor and the peeling frescoes dancing on the walls around them. She was rummaging through a small bundle of wares in the corner, blankets, pots, a ruthless-looking dagger, and a leather sack of something he hoped was food. This was her hiding place, her stash, or someone else's stash that she'd taken advantage of. He watched as Lehman spread the blanket out over the ground, snapping it to shake the dust free. Nicholas felt himself take his first deep breath in hours. Lehman drew her lantern closer and unknotted the laces of her hooded cloak to drape over Sophia's shivering form. She wore an approximation of the longer, draped dresses he'd seen on the women of Carthage, her hair braided into a crown around her head. She worked silently, her fingers pressing along a point on Sophia's neck. Then she leaned forward, an ear to Sophia's chest.
Is she dead?
Nicholas asked, voice hoarse. Lehman sat back, shook her head.
She lives. Barely.
I brought...
Nicholas fumbled with the physician's bag, yanking it over his head and passing it to her.
I brought this. Do you know anything of medicine? Of poison?
She snatched the leather bag and began sorting through its contents, lining up each sachet, small bottle, and pressed herb on the ground beside her. She stopped now and then to sniff one, or dab a drop of liquid on her tongue.
Sit her up,
Lehman commanded at last, seizing one of the small bottles and uncorking it.
Hold her jaw open with care. or else you'll break it.
He rolled his stiffening shoulder back, trying to loosen it into use, and felt a trickle of fresh blood race down the curve of his spine. His thoughts took on a flickering quality that set off a clanging bell inside his skull. Still, he did as Li Min asked, sitting Sophia's slack body up and tilting her head back. He used his index finger and thumb to nudge her jaw open wide enough for Li Min to pour whatever was in the bottle down Sophia's throat. She measured it out, sip by sip, her free hand stroking Sophia's face sweetly, like a delicate spring rain.
"What? What is that?" he demanded. "Won't she choke?"
Sophia had been nothing but dead weight from the moment he'd carried her out of the house in Carthage, but she'd at least had her usual barbed edges and venom. Over the course of 10, 15 minutes, it had all bled away, leaving nothing but a husk of bones and skin. But now she returned to life, seemingly all at once, retching, gagging, and then casting up her accounts all over him with a wet, putrid splatter. Her eyes remained closed, but he could feel her breathing more steadily now, the puffs of it warming the air between them.
"Dear God,"
he said in alarm, pounding on her back to help her clear her throat. "The smell. The smell."
"Something to help her get the vile poison out of her," Li Min said, finally answering his earlier questions.
"Thank you,"
he said, wiping his chin against the shoulder of his tunic.
"For that timely warning."
"Lay her back,"
Li Min said, sitting back on her heels.
"She needs to rest now. Some of the poison has been absorbed by her body, but we may have luck on our side yet. The Thorn's intention wasn't to kill her. Ironwood's bounty specifies he wants you both alive, or else the payment will be forfeit."
Nicholas didn't realize his sword hadn't made the journey with them until he'd tried reaching for it. His fingers had to settle for a broken shard of stone, some crumbled section of the statue behind them.
"Is that the reason you've come, then? You caught wind of the bounty and knew where to find us?"
Li Min snorted, smoothing Sophia's hair out of her face.
"I came to ensure I might be able to claim my end to our bargain. The bounty is a handsome windfall from the gods, but the Ironwoods can rot."
"I warn you,"
Nicholas blinked, trying to clear the spots floating in his vision.
"I warn you that we won't be taken."
Li Min ignored him, taking Sophia's hand. She spoke to the other young woman firmly, leaning over her as if to drag her spirit back, should it try to escape. And with time, those same words became embroidered with soft pleading, though their meaning couldn't penetrate the fog growing in his mind.
"Let's not."
Nicholas tried to push up onto his feet, but the world swung wild and unhinged around him, knocking him back into place.
"Won't be taken."
The ring on his hand burned as he felt his body betray him. Nicholas slumped back to the ground, fighting the way the light faded around him, gently receding in waves, until there was nothing left of the world but blissful emptiness. Nicholas woke to a sharp complaint from his left shoulder, a badgering, insistent sting that dragged him forward again each time he tried to slip back into the darkness. He was flat on his stomach, the side of his face pressed against the ridges of the mosaic beneath him. By the time his vision cleared and the cotton stuffing inside his skull was plucked out, Nicholas had the very disturbing realization that someone was stabbing him repeatedly, and quite literally, in the back.
"You!"
His attempt to surge off the ground was met with firm resistance. A hand easily pushed him back down.
"Be still while I finish," the voice growled back. "Unless you'd like me to accidentally sew your neck to your shoulder. It might improve your looks."
Li Min. His gaze pivoted. From his vantage point, he could just see Sophia, still stretched out on the ground. The tiny bottles, herbs, and medicines had been stowed in the bag again. But now Li Min was rummaging through it for something else, muttering to herself. When she returned, her touch was as rough and uncaring as it had been before.
"Did you give me something? To make me pass out,
he asked, teeth gritted. He'd had at least a dozen slashes stitched up in his career at sea, and the feeling of being sewn back together like a doll never improved. Li Min leaned forward, so he had a clear view of her face as she raised a dark brow.
No. You are weak and faltering, not only in body, it would appear, but in judgment.
He followed her gaze to where his hand was splayed out against the dirt. The ring looked like a tattoo in the darkness.
Nonsense, he said, even as the band burned, tightened.
The wave of nausea that passed through him momentarily stole the feeling from his lower half. Nicholas jerked, bucking like a horse.
Settle yourself, Li Min ordered. Activity will only make her poison work faster. I might ask you what you traded this favor for, but I already know. You were a fool, but you are even more foolish to avoid the terms of your contract. What was her task?
Murder,
he muttered.
Ah, was her reply. A life for a life, then.
You might have warned us, he said, letting the bitterness bleed into his voice.
I never thought you foolish enough to go through with it, she said simply.
Foolish, he agreed. And desperate. Where are we?
She continued her work.
The necropolis of the Vatican. 1499.
He rubbed at his eyes, clearing the dust and grime. He'd been right then to feel as though they were descending through the levels of hell to the dark heart of the earth. There was another sarcophagus flush against the far wall, and he wondered idly if they'd moved the poor occupant from his rest upstairs to this chamber. More importantly, he wondered who they were.
Is this your hiding place? He asked.
If nothing else, talking was a distraction.
Yes, it belongs to a particular line of my family. The Hemlock clan, I should say.
Li Min pressed a hand flat against his bare back, holding him steady. The last surge of pain was short, at least. She knotted the thread she'd used to patch the wound in his shoulder, and gave him a pitying pat on the head. He wasn't feeling up to it, but he forced himself to sit up regardless, hating the disadvantage the prostrate position had put him in. The Ironwoods and Lindens had secret homes and hoards. He shouldn't have been surprised to find the same of the Hemlock family. Li Min made another of her disapproving noises, pushing him back down.
This was used as a place to amass treasure and documents, until it was forgotten. Someone sold me its secrets for a price.
Seems a rather inconvenient hiding place for you, he noted, rubbing the back of his neck. To have to go through the hassle of Carthage to arrive here.
It's abandoned in every era, up until the 20th century. And there are many, many passages in the Papal City, as you know. 3 in this year alone.
He didn't, but Nicholas nodded nonetheless.
What is your plan, if not to bring us back to Ironwood?
She's unconscious, and you're as weak as a lamb, Li Min reminded him. You've trusted me this far. I do wish to receive recompense for the gold that was stolen from me. But I am curious about this mission of yours. How it ties to the many threads that are reverberating throughout time.
We've already spent it. Your gold. There's nothing left. And we've nothing else to trade you.
You've that gold.
She pointed to the leather string tied around his neck. Etta's earring.
That is not nothing.
His hand closed over the earring and the glass pendant.
If you think about touching this, you will lose more than a hand.
Li Min looked doubtful at that, her dark brows lifting in pity.
You can have this, he said hopefully,
holding up the hand with the ring. Sensation had fully returned to it. His arm felt unusually stiff, but cooperated as he tested its range of movement. Perhaps he had simply torn a muscle, as he'd originally believed.
I'd have to cut it off, which would only kill you faster, she informed him.
Hell and damnation. That confirmed the Belladonna's warning.
Where did you come by that amulet? She asked after a moment,
pointing to the large bead he'd been given.
"A boy gave it to me," he said.
"A stranger?"
"Yes, what of it?"
She shrugged. "Nothing. Everything. He wished you protection and good fortune. It has value. Do not part with it for anything less than your life."
"If it is so valuable, then why don't you take it to cancel our debt?"
"It is not the object that holds power, but the intention behind it. The wish made when it changed hands. I could no more steal that than I could take the light from the stars."
Something in her words rattled him to his core. I shouldn't have accepted it. Who needed protection more than that child?
"I suppose you see yourself as protection and good fortune," he said, wiping the sweat from his face.
"How you wish to see me is your choice," she said. "For now, you should know that I am your only chance of survival."
Neither friend nor foe, it seemed. More a temporary ally, the way Sophia had ultimately come to fit into his life. Nicholas looked around again, drawing his knees to his chest.
"As long as we don't run out of air, this will be a suitable hiding place."
"It is convenient, too," she said idly. "If you die, I can leave you down here."
"If Sophia dies, you mean?"
he said, surprised at the tightening in his throat. Li Min shook her head.
"She will not die. Too stubborn. Too much left unfinished. It's you I fear for, huffing and puffing like a locomotive over a minor flesh wound."
"A minor?"
Nicholas fought his wince. To knot the tattered remains of his pride, he added,
"I've seen myself through far worse than this."
Li Min made a disbelieving sound at the back of her throat.
"Running from Ironwoods?"
"Shipboardings," he said. "My..."
Nicholas paused, then continued.
"My adoptive... father. He is a captain."
How strange that he'd never referred to Hall that way aloud. It was always the captain, or the man who raised me. But for all his hesitance to put that label to it in his own era, Nicholas had always known the truth in his heart. As a grown man and an officer on Hall's ship, he hadn't wanted the others to feel he was receiving preferential treatment, or that he hadn't earned his position there. As a child, some part of him had feared that Hall might face judgment if Nicholas went around telling that to others, less forward-thinking people of their century. What a poisonous thing it was to distance himself from a man he loved, a man who had cared for him, for fear of what others might think. He craned his neck back to find Li Min's dark eyes studying him. When she didn't break her gaze, he realized he hadn't finished his thought.
"Fought off pirates for years on voyages, and then became a legal one at the outbreak of the war. Sorry, the American War for Independence. There's been quite a number of them, hasn't there?"
"Pirate?" Li Min said with disbelief. "No chance."
"And what do you know of it?"
Nicholas said, trying to straighten his shoulders. He felt her shrug.
"It's not an insult. I only mean to say you'd hesitate before cutting off a man's head to steal his gold teeth. It's not a qualm you're allowed in that line of work."
"Fair point.
Spent a lot of time with pirates, have you?"
To his surprise, she said,
"Yes. I served under Qin Shi for 10 years. From... the time I was a child."
"Who the devil is that?"
Nicholas asked curiously.
"A pirate unrivaled," Li Min said. "There is no greater one in all of history."
"When did he live? Or she?"
She seemed appeased by this, her gaze softening slightly.
"Qingxie bridged the 18th and 19th centuries. She was born in 1775. Tens of thousands came under her command, and she beat back whole empires."
That partly explained why he hadn't recognized her name. That and the biases of the West had likely prevented her legend from spreading past the Pacific.
"What came of her?"
"She successfully negotiated her retirement."
"Impressive,"
he said, because it was. More than glory or infamy, successful pirates were those who survived the endeavor and didn't drown, hang, or rot in prison. He stored the story away, to save for Etta.